I'm Emily Brennan, and welcome to the podcast. Here's your 90-second pro bono update. First, Legal Services Corporation, America's largest funder of civil legal aid programs for low-income people, is launching statewide online legal portals to direct individuals with civil legal needs to the most appropriate forms of assistance. Visit lsc.gov to learn more. As part of National Reentry Week this spring, the Justice Center of the Council of State Governments released a Federal Interagency Reentry Council fact sheet as part of efforts to reduce recidivism. Check it out at csgjusticecenter.org. Make sure you read the April edition of Nonprofit Quarterly for the article titled, In Louisiana, Lack of Public Defender Funding Systematically Threatens Sixth Amendment. It details how private attorneys have been appointed as public defenders due to a lack of funding and are going to court to halt the practice. You can find it on nonprofitquarterly.org. We can't help but mention a new study from Penn Law's Max Weiss and Wendell Pritchett comparing local funding of schools in major U.S. cities. The study titled Local School Funding, A Comparison of Philadelphia and Other Major Cities Over the Past Decade is available on Professor Wendell Pritchett's page via law.upenn.edu. And finally, the Association of Pro Bono Counsel, made up of lawyers who manage pro bono practices at large law firms, has released its inaugural annual report detailing the work of their members in areas including housing, family law, employment, domestic violence, and healthcare. Take a look at apbco.org. And now, here's the episode's interview.
Welcome, everyone, to the podcast. I'm Arlene Rivera-Finkelstein, and for this episode, we are delighted to have Benjamin Crump, president of the National Bar Association, joining us. Mr. Crump is best known, perhaps, for representing the families of Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, and unfortunately, many others who have been assaulted and even killed by the police. Mr. Crump, we are so pleased to have you here today and to be able to speak with you about the work that you are doing. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Arlene. Thank you so much to the Penn Law family for having me and having this important conversation at your conference.
Thank you. Mr. Crump, if we could start by talking about your clients. Tell us about your clients. Tell us about the individuals who have sought your assistance.
Certainly. Arlene, it's not lost on me or many people that at the end of this week will mark the tragic anniversary of the killing of Trayvon Martin, the 17-year-old who was walking home with a bag of Skittles and a can of iced tea, who was killed by Neighborhood Watch volunteer George Zimmerman. And when I think of my clients, I think of all of them. I think of Trayvon's parents, Sabrina and Tracy, just such outstanding people who evolve to turn tragedy into triumph and to serve as an example for so many others who have to deal with losing loved ones to acts of senseless gun violence, to Michael Brown's family, Ferguson, Missouri, Tamir Rice's father. The list goes on and on and on. Martley Anderson, Marlon Brown, Eric Gardner. It's just too many to name. I think about the women, the 13 black women who were raped by the police officer in Oklahoma City. You know, it's just one thing after another. Corey Jones family, the church drummer who was on the side of the road waiting for the tow truck man and an undercover police officer in an unmarked van and in plain clothes approaches him at 3 in the morning. And for whatever reason, 3 minutes later, Corey Jones is dead. You know, it's these clients who we work with all the time. The work we do with the Innocence Project, where you have wrongfully convicted individuals in prison sometimes for 25 years, and you working to try to get them out of prison because the evidence is so overwhelming of their innocence, but yet the system is slow, and you know we look for the usual suspects who are normally little black and brown people to in prison and warehouse and try to as easy as possible make sure that we find somebody to hold accountable for the wrongdoing, no matter what the evidence says. And so those are who my clients are, the regular folk, the individuals. That we talked about the vacancy on the Supreme Court, and one of the things that has been acknowledged widely is that we don't appoint Supreme Court justices anymore that were litigants on behalf of regular individuals. Normally, we are appointing people who represent corporations and work for big firms that defend, automakers, tobacco industry, those type of things, or a career prosecutor who's never, ever did anything but represent the government. And so we hope that we can get diversity on the Supreme Court bench. But now I make that point to say it really is something unique when you represent individuals.
And how does that conversation go? What do you say to the parents of a child who's been killed by police when they come to you grieving and looking for some sort of justice?
Well, the humanity of the situation is, as a parent, the first thing you do is you empathize with them that no matter what we do in the legal system, it's not going to bring your child back. And that's the hard part of it. Because what they want most is their child back. So what you do, Arlene, you tell them, well, we're going to try to get you the answers. We're going to fight harder than anybody's going to fight to try to get you the answers of what happened to your child, your loved one. And, especially when it's children, it's against the natural order of things. And, a lot of these are little black and brown boys, and a lot of times they're teenagers and they're right on the cusp of manhood. It's so difficult just having to deal with the reality when you think he's gone. I think about Trayvon's family, his mother and father, and we're fighting so hard just to get the killer arrested and charged. And I remember we go up to New York about 4 weeks after the tragedy, and thank God through social media, it's driving major media, so we have all these interviews set up to go talk about the situation. And we go to Today Show, Good Morning America, CBS, The View, Anderson Cooper, all the way to Reverend Al Sharpton, Politics Nation Show, MSNBC. And Arlene, it is so hard because Trace and Sabrina, they're doing these interviews and they're telling the story about their child and the tragedy that took place. And at the end of every interview, it's so painful because it ends the same way. Your child has a bullet hole to his heart and he's never coming back. But they have to keep telling that story over and over again just to try to get justice. So you can't even really grieve because you're so hard trying to fight for the legacy and the honor of your child. And so that is real difficult to do. Some people can't do it, and that's why I do credit them with being so wonderful for fighting the fight, and by doing that, it was an example for so many others to fight the fight for their children, because there have been children being getting killed a long time. And I think of Martin Lee Anderson's parents. That was the boot camp case I handled in 2006, where a little 14-year-old black boy on his first day at a juvenile boot camp was kicked and punched and ammonia tablets stuffed in his nose by 8 security guards, and he ended up dying. And even though we got a $10 million civil settlement, none of the police officers on that videotape, that grainy surveillance videotape, what you watch kill that young man, were held accountable. And so those are and the conversations are a lot the same. They get on the phone with that sense of hopelessness, that sense of just brokenheartedness. I still can't describe 4 years later the sound that was coming out of Trayvon's father's voice. Trayvon, I met Tracy Martin the first time I talked to him. I mean, he's a manly man, you know, truck driver, everything. He, you know, he's done a lot of television interviews and people see him. He has the bald head with the beard and the women seem to like how he looks and everything. But Tracy came on the phone and I mean, it's almost like he was whining because there it's so clear when you listen to him. He really loved this child. And he's has a hole in his heart that no matter what, it's never going to be repaired. And when he was telling me about what happened to his child when it first happened, you could tell he was just completely devastated.
You know, Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, Oscar Grant, I can go on. There's more cases than we want to acknowledge are out there. But it seems we're talking about much more than any one case. When you walk down the street, when you walk into a room, people thank you, people reach out to you, people recognize you. It seems that this has grown beyond any individual case into something quite different.
Certainly.
What is it? When did you realize that?
You know, I think when I got the call from Antonio Montez Zambrano's family, it kind of made me understand that this was far bigger than just Trayvon Martin matter or Michael Brown and Ferguson matter. This was a matter of national proportions where anybody could be profiled unjustly and their life could be taken, and what people wanted was somebody to fight for the honor and dignity of their child's life, of their husband or their brother or their sister's life. And so when I am in the public, people often empathize that I got boys and girls, and I understand, but by the grace of God, there go I. And I mean, it doesn't matter if you're rich or you're poor. It seems to be if you're a minority, for whatever reason, you're profiled to a large extent, and you have to have the conversation with your children that, you know, you might can't do everything that your little white friends do because the world, and it's so unfair, but the world looks differently upon their perceptions of you. And so to every parent out there, some, you know, I talk to my white colleagues, and at times they cannot fathom. I mean, it's just foreign to them that their child can be walking home from the 7-Eleven and the police or a quasi-police person, somebody who's supposed to protect and serve them, would kill them. You know, I talk to Penn Law students, and I challenge them to go look at, you know, these incidents all over YouTube where you have people being shot by the police in the back, handcuffed, running away, all these type of scenarios. And they all said they were in fear of their life. And then they got this thing called criming while white. When you go look at it, you see white people doing way worse things than these little black boys, and nobody gets shot. In fact, Dylan Roof, the boy killed all those innocent people. I mean, the most innocent people you could ever find in that church in Charleston. In fact, he said he felt bad about it, Arlene, because they were so nice to him. But yeah, he massacred and shot all those people. They catch him, and what do the police do? They take him by Burger King on the way to the jail. And you say, wow, if any of these people who didn't kill nobody, Trayvon, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, Eric Ramsey, Alicia Thomas, Raquel Boyd, Renisha McBride, Jonathan Wallace, any of these people, Corey Jones, any consideration that would have been given to them, they might be living because they didn't kill nobody. But they're the ones who we want to classify as thugs and criminals and so forth. But the person who massacred 9 people in a church, we say, well, he has psychological issues.
Now, this is a battle that is playing out in 2 different arenas, right? We have the criminal justice system to see who's going to be held accountable.
Yes.
For these acts of violence. And we have the civil justice system for a different kind of accountability. Describe for us how this plays out in each of those.
Certainly. In America, we have a constitution that gives us a right to recover civilly as well as hold the person accountable for committing criminal acts. Oftentimes, what has happened, people normally get one or the other. You know, if somebody goes to jail, they normally say, we ain't going to give you the civil settlement when it's in the minority community. Or if you get a civil settlement, they say you should be happy. Ain't nobody going to jail, namely the police officers who committed the heinous act. What we have to do is when you have the criminal act done and it's a law enforcement officer, the narrative is being framed or quasi law enforcement. The narrative is being framed, and you have to get out there and challenge the narrative. Because if you don't say anything, it don't matter if the person shot in the back, the person running away, person got a handcuff when the police shoot them, they're going to accept the police version. So what I do right away, I start challenging the narrative, asking the questions, calling out questionable facts that they're trying to tell us, because you got to frame that narrative if you want any chance of the person being held accountable criminally. And then from the civil perspective, you got to make sure you can overcome qualified immunity and the Monell claims that show policy and custom. You got to work hard to overcome the qualified immunity motion to dismiss that says, well, just because it was one bad act and so forth, we're not going to hold the city accountable. And the only thing there is to recover is monetary damages. And the city is trying to get out of paying monetary damages. And you just have to fight to show a pattern or policy or custom to be able to recover. Other than that, you can get a multi-million-dollar result from the police officer. He ain't got no money. It really is about, can you hold the city and the police department accountable for what their employee did to your loved one? So oftentimes, you have to go through extreme ways to make sure you can recover, because everybody wants to protect the police officers, no matter what the fact pattern is. And so when you're trying to show custom or policy, the courts are continuing saying, well, that's similar. That's not like we have here. And so you're arguing where in the last 4 years, they've killed 57 people and 47 of them being minorities. So we think there's a pattern when it comes to dealing with minorities, there's excessive force. Just say that's not enough. Then you got to say, okay, well, they killed them when they were running away. And it's like, okay, well, were they all shot or was some of them tased? And, I mean, they just make you jump through hoop after hoop to be able to do it. And that's why you got to keep fighting and challenge the intellectual justification that the courts and everybody try to give for the killings of unarmed people of color. And it bears saying, you know, what I call it, Arlene, I call it the government-sanctioned killings of unarmed people of color. And people get upset and say, how can you say that? And I keep saying, if nobody's held accountable over and over again when it happened, how do you not say the government is sanctioning the killings? I don't know how you look at Laquan McDonough and conclude that it was anything but a legal execution of that kid while he's running away.
I mean, it begs the question, if this is on video, if we can see what happened, why is criminal liability ever in question?
Because, like Dr. King said, you know, we have to have more people stand up to unjust laws because, you know, lawyers can intellectually justify anything. I mean, truly, we can. And it sounds plausible and so forth until you step back and say, but hold on, this was a human life. What about the humanity? What about the morals of it? What about the ethics? And, you know, Dr. King talked about, you know, at the end of the day, how are we going to be measured? What did you do in times of comfort and convenience versus times of conflict and controversy? Where did you stand? And we have to take a stand for right. Moral people have to stand up against unjust laws. Us lawyers, us officers of the court, the most equipped, the most skilled, the most articulate, the most educated, the most intellectual, we have to use those blessings for the least of ye. We got to stand up for the people who need the law and the protection of the law most, and that is poor people, regular citizens and so forth, not these special interests, these corporate interests. You know, we have to take a stand for right. And if we don't, shame on us when or if it ever comes to our doorstep.
Now, these cases are absolutely the worst, right? There's no question that these are egregious acts of violence. But when you consider the high volume of law enforcement activity on a regular basis across the country, what leads you to the conclusion that this is a systematic problem rather than individual law enforcement failures?
I think it's a systematic problem because you see it happening over and over again, but you see what the responses are in place. When you look at the grand jury system, how over and over again they can get 99.9% indictments on everybody else except when it's a police officer accused of killing an unarmed person of color or having excessive force against a person of color, then you just don't get an indictment. And so it begs the question, can you ever have a state attorney who has a symbiotic relationship with the police officers that they work with every day and depend on to help build their cases to really honestly go and then prosecute the same officer that for years they've tried to build up the credibility on? It just begs to question who polices the police.
So who should police the police?
Well, I think it should be a system in place, an independent system. The grand jury system as we have it now is broken. It doesn't work when it comes to police excessive force cases. So Congressman Hank Johnson out of Atlanta, Georgia, has put forth proposed legislation to have grand jury reform, which would change the way we do it, where you have the secret proceeding and the prosecutor go in and it's all citizens and he or she the only lawyer in the room. And 9 times out of 10, they going to do whatever he says. So if he want an indictment, he gets an indictment. If he doesn't want an indictment, he doesn't get an indictment. But then he gets to come and wash the blood off his hands and say, well, it was the grand jury's decision. And nobody knew what happened there, so everybody kind of let him get the blood off his hands by saying, oh, it was the grand jury decision, which is a lot of bull. Everybody knows it's the prosecutor's decision because whatever the prosecutor wants in a grand jury, he's going to get. So we need to change that system, and we need to have it where he goes and presents what he believes is his probable cause evidence before somebody who knows the law, like a judge. And the judge is better equipped to ask questions about whether or not this probable cause affidavit is sufficient. Is the evidence sufficient and so forth? And a safeguard on that is that it should absolutely be where it's public, that everybody can see what happened and so forth, so there can be some accountability. And so if you treat Leroy different than you treat the police officer, it should be noted in the public when it comes to electing those officers again can see what they actually did when they dealt with these issues that affect our community versus what people say they did. And the last part of that, and if it's a police shooting, it should be independent prosecutor that comes in instead of the local prosecutor making the arguments to the judge, because you still have that symbiotic relationship there with the local prosecutor.
Now, you were recently at the White House with a number of civil rights leaders invited by President Obama to have a conversation about these issues. Were solutions like the one you've just described discussed?
Yes, and Attorney General Loretta Lynch was present, and we talked about the Criminal Justice Reform Act. We talked about the President's 21st Century Police Task Force, which your former police chief, Ramsey, headed up on behalf of the President. And we talked about how you make these things happen. And the Attorney General committed that this was a primary objective for her office as it relates to the proposed legislation Hank Johnson put forward. They agree they can try to help, but really that has to come through the U.S. Congress to become law. He said he certainly will sign a bill, any bill they put on his desk relating to that there, but we got to get it through the Congress.
Do you see a future where we stop fighting over who's wrong and start working together to fix a system that's clearly not working?
Only if we have moral-minded individuals all agree to be moral about the situation on both sides. That is the only way we can get this tragic, just unbelievable killings, senseless acts of gun violence from happening. You got to have people who buy into the belief that we got to find stuff to bring us together versus stuff that divides us. And I think we all love our children just as much as anybody else. And we have to talk about that. When teenage boys and girls are being killed, you got to hold somebody accountable so people will have faith that in America, everybody gets their due process. This whole notion of fairness, on this notion of impartiality on both parties, whether it's the government or the individual.
4 years after Trayvon, are we better or worse?
It depends on what lens you look at it from. Certainly, you can see progress in some things, and you can see that we're going back in others. I've always subscribed to the philosophy that it's better to strike a match than to curse the darkness. And so I try to look at the positive side, but I'm realistic enough to know with the advent of technology, the more we see these videos, other people may think differently.
And if any of our listeners want to be a part of making this system better?
It's not very hard. All you have to do is agree to commit to trying to make the world a better place for our children. And you can join us at whether it's nationalbar.org. That's the website and the email for the National Bar Association, of which I'm president, Arlene. I represent 66,000 black lawyers, judges, and legal professionals in America and beyond. And so we speak robustly on behalf of not just the leadership, but all our membership. My Twitter account is at Attorney Crump. That's spelled like attorney, A-T-T-O-R-N-E-Y. Crump, C as in Charlie, R-U-M-P. And I try to respond as best I can to Twitter. So yeah, they can email me at bcrump@parks, P-A-R-K-S, crump, C-R-U-M-P.com. And we're all in this together, so I welcome your advice and counsel. Penn Law, in fact, I expect it.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Mr. Crump. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I know this is just the beginning of the conversation.
Well, the honor has certainly been mine, Arlene, for my entire visit to Penn Law. You all are very special people. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crump, and thanks to our listeners. We look forward to having you join us for our next episode of the podcast.
This podcast was produced by the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Learn more about public interest lawyering at law.upenn.edu/public service. Thanks for joining us.